everyone. This is the Ready for Launch podcast, a show where we break down product launches, share our favorites, and explain why they work. I'm Andy McOtter-Bicknell, and I'm here with my co-hosts Tamara Graminski and Jason Oakley.
And as a reminder, the show is brought to you by our friends over at the Compete Network, powered by Clue.
And the topic for this episode is best pre-2000s launch. Or a couple other ways you can think about it is best 20th century launch, best pre-internet launch, whatever way you think about it is no internet. No, this is all like pre-digital age, okay? And so Jason, why don't you tell us first? Because I know that you had a little bit of a struggle juggling between two specific launches for your pick. So why don't you tell us about the one that you did not choose? Don't spoil it, but just tell us the one that you ultimately decided not to go with.
Yeah, so I had thought of a couple originally, but for a while I was going to go with chicken nuggets. So I had picked it because I was going to, and this is like McDonald's when they launched the chicken McNuggets.
Like the McNugget in particular. McNugget,
not nuggets. Okay. And that's actually one interesting thing, because I thought at the time that they were the ones to create the nugget concept. Turns out they're not. Nuggets were created by someone else at a different time.
Okay.
So it really wasn't that impressive. They just basically had a chicken McNugget launch.
Yeah. Did you ever see the movie The Founder?
Like the one about Ray Kroc?
McDonald's.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And good. How like all the individual McDonald's in the very beginning had like a really unique menu. And like some of them, I'm pretty sure sold tacos and like a bunch of other kind of like random things. Like I would have loved to have a McDonald's taco back in the day. That would have been so awesome.
Yeah. I think they had a ton of issues with like their franchisees just going rogue and doing their own thing. Mm-hmm. And then they brought in the Ron Swanson guy who like streamlined the whole thing.
Yeah.
The
Yeah, exactly.
And talking about pre-internet, though, do you remember the pizzas that McDonald's used to sell? Yeah. Like, that was a childhood staple for me. That's what I think about when I think about the 20th century, you know?
I'm surprised they haven't tried to bring that back.
I don't remember this at all. They made pizza?
Oh, this is aging us, Jason.
Yeah, they had a pizza. Sorry. They also, that was...
like personal pan or by the slice? What was it?
Personal pan. Was this a Canadian thing? Okay. We're going to do some research about this. We'll share our research in the show notes.
Yeah, it was great.
Yeah, and
it was
very awesome.
Yeah, it was really good. I think it kind of reminds me of like Pizza Hut pizza when I eat it today.
Not to derail, but I actually have a fact about McDonald's pizza.
Come in. Here we go.
You were born on the day they got rid of the pizza?
No. But apparently McDonald's pizza wasn't as successful as they originally thought it was going to be. It was kind of a failure because they made some mistakes along the way. Apparently, one of the big ones was the pizza box they designed was actually too wide for the drive-through windows. And there were some other logistical errors, but I know like that's kind of why you don't see it today. It was considered sort of like a failure.
Grayson, you should come on one of our episodes.
Logistics. Yeah. Well, I don't,
maybe I win today's episode.
No. Get out of here, Grayson. Okay. Listen, let's get into it though. All right. So we got our McDonald's out of the way. We're not talking about McDonald's. Jason already cut them out of the equation here. We have three choices though. We each have our picks for best pre-internet launch. So let's get into it. Do we want to randomize and figure out who's going to go first?
Yes. So the randomizer, it speaks again and we know it never lies. Can I get a drum roll, please? And the first is Andy McOtter-Bicknell.
Yes.
This is your first, Andy?
All right. This is my first time going first. I need to do some breathing exercises. Okay. Okay, here we go. I'm very excited for this one. Let's do it.
3, 2, 1.
All right, so my pick is the Michelin Guide. Do either of y'all know the backstory for the Michelin Guide? Tamara, Jason?
I do, but I only found out a few years ago and I was pretty blown away.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Jason, do you know this one?
I know a bit, but I'm sure I'm going to learn something here. So I'm excited.
All right. Yeah, this was really fun to research. It's pretty interesting. So first, let me lay out what I consider, you know, a successful pre-internet launch. So in my opinion, the best pre-internet launch should have three things. Number one, lasting power. In other words, the product or the launch, you know, is it still relevant today? Are we still talking about it? Number two, it should be innovative. It should be unique in the way that they approach launching the product. And number three, should have a really big market response. And so did the launch, did it help the company capture new market share or maintain momentum over time? Okay, so those were the three categories that I was kind of thinking about in the back of my head when I picked the Michelin Guide. And for context, the Michelin Guide, for those that don't know, I mean, if you're a foodie of any kind, and you're in the culinary or the hospitality industry, then you're aware of the Michelin Guide. But essentially every single year since 1926, they've gone around and put together a list of the best restaurants to eat by giving them 1, 2, or 3 stars. And over time, this rating system has really become synonymous with fine dining. And so it's a really, really, really big deal in the culinary space. But the thing is, and why I love this launch is because Michelin is a tire company. They are not, you know, rooted in the culinary space or hospitality. Like you'd think that a publisher of a guide of this magnitude, like they'd be some kind of like independent reporter or maybe a newspaper magazine, something like that. No, this is literally a French tire company. And the launch story goes like this. Okay. So Michelin was one of the first tire companies in France. They were established in 1889 when there were fewer than 3,000 cars in the entire country. And they thought, hey, how do we get more people to buy more tires? Well, they need to drive more. How do we get them to drive more? Well, we should probably give them a list of recommended places to drive to. And so that's what they did. But at first, this list wasn't just restaurants. It was, you know, maps. It was where to fill up on gas, other info like that. The first iteration of the guide was fine, but it wasn't what it's known today. You know, the infamous Michelin Guide. It wasn't until about 2 decades later when they made 2 changes that would really unlock the next level of success. The first change was they restructured the guide. They focused more on restaurants and hotels because they noticed that that was typically like the most read sections, and they established the star rating system. So they just tweaked the format a little bit. And the second change to this guide was that they started charging for it. So previously it was free and was monetized through ads. Now they're moving forward and they decided to ditch the ads. And they hired a team of mystery diners to review restaurants more formally and actually give them these star ratings. And I can't reiterate this enough, guys. This is a tire company. Their primary business is selling tires. Okay. We're still in 2024. You know, we're having arguments about content strategy for businesses. And I bet if you recommended to your boss to hire a small team to serve a tangential category with minimal revenue attribution, you'd get laughed out of the room. So the fact that this happened in the mid-1920s just goes to show just how ahead of the curve Michelin was. And we're still talking about the impact. Okay, so that's the whole impetus for the Michelin Guide and how it came to be. But let's talk about the scoreboard, right? Like what is the lasting power of the Michelin Guide? Well, lasting power was one of the categories that I initially had when I was thinking about best pre-internet launches. Do they have lasting power? Yeah, absolutely. In fact, I'd say that if a restaurant has a Michelin star, that's one of the first things that they mention when they're marketing to someone. Or if someone mentions something about a restaurant that has a Michelin star, then they'll mention that it has a Michelin star. And you're more likely to go and visit that restaurant just because it is associated with that rating system. The second piece, innovation. Was it innovative for its time? 100%. Michelin is a tire company, and it saw an opportunity to get people to buy more tires by getting them to travel to restaurants and hotels more. So absolutely genius. And number 3, big market response. Did it help Michelin improve market share and brand presence? Yes, absolutely. It's widely believed that the Michelin Guide contributes to the overall Michelin brand and reputation. It's helped restaurants increase their revenue when they're awarded stars. It's boosted tourism in other countries. And again, all this is from, I keep saying it, but a tire company, guys. It's a tire company. And so again, this isn't just like a legendary pre-2000s launch. It's a legendary launch, period. And that's my pitch. Ooh. Let me know what you guys think.
Nice.
I was very excited when I heard that you were doing the Michelin Guide. I have a love-hate relationship with the Michelin Guide because I love to eat. I am a foodie. And whenever I travel anywhere, the first thing I do when I'm researching for that city is I go to the Michelin Guide app. There's an awesome app. I filter by that city and I try to decide, like, where am I going to eat when I go here? But then on the flip side, it's like, any place that has a star is so hard to get into. The prices are more expensive. So that's where the love-hate comes from. But I remember, Andy, I actually had no idea that it was the tire company. And I feel kind of dumb even admitting this until a few years ago.
Same. I'm the same way. Okay. Actually, that was a big, like, recurring thing for me. I was like, in the back of my mind, was it? Are they associated at all? And then I finally Googled and I was like, oh, they are. That's cool. But you know what? Like, the thing is, like, I don't know if I could mention this tells a little bit about me. I don't know many other tire companies. You guys, listen, like, not a big car guy over here, but I know who Michelin is, and I think that just the fact that they're able to get their name out there in this way, in this like roundabout but still related way, it was really, really cool.
So is the Michelin Guide still, and like that app and that sort of thing, is that still ran within the Michelin company? Like, yeah, they just have a department that runs the guide?
Yeah, they still publish it.
Fair.
Yeah, yeah. So they have their own website. They update it every single year. They've expanded it a little bit. So it's more than just like one, two, or three stars. And it's primarily hotels and restaurants. But then, yeah, you go to their website and they have kind of like a directory where you can look at, and you can filter by the different stars, and you can read a little bit about each restaurant. They have it mapped out because it's international. Like, they have the Michelin rating system throughout just about every single country. It's like France has the most, which makes sense because it's a French, Michelin is a French company. But then it goes, I think it's like France, Japan, then the US in terms of like the number of restaurants that have like a Michelin star. It's pretty interesting. It's worth going through and just kind of like flipping through for a few minutes for sure.
Fun fact, it just came to Canada last year, so it was not in Canada. And I will say, you know, I feel like I'm making Andy's argument for him here, but I will say it's incredible to see the impact it does have on a market, because we didn't have it in Canada. Then it came, and it has like completely changed the Vancouver food scene. It's the first thing people have on their doors. People, to your point, Andy, people talk about it, advertise their business that way. But also, anyone that got a star or even a Bib Gourmand, which is essentially just like a highly recommended rating, is jacked up their prices. And you cannot get a Rezzo in them. So it's a testament, truly, to the power of a brand.
Yeah, absolutely. Michelin's done some other really cool, like non just like tire specific marketing that's worth looking into and talking about as well. But I think the Michelin Guide system is probably the most well-known one. And again, yeah, like, it's just the fact that other people talk about it so much that it keeps like their brand reputation. It's like the gift that keeps on giving, I feel like. And so it's definitely something that a lot of, I feel like, brands can learn about, is investing in these kind of tangential areas that maybe aren't so directly in line with your product category, but they serve other complementary areas as well.
Totally.
Nice.
You might call it a sidecar product, Andy.
You might. I actually, yes. Like when I picked this one, I was like, damn it, this is kind of like a sidecar thing, but you know, it's fine. It's all serving the same purpose. Yeah.
I like that.
All right, Grayson, I think we're ready for whoever's next. You want to let us know?
Yes. All right. I have it. Drum roll, please.
Here we go.
And second, we have Jason Oakley.
We're Jason. Here we go. You got this.
3, 2, 1.
All right. So my launch is the Jordan 1s, soon after called Air Jordans. Okay. So let me set the stage here. So 1984, it's a big year in pop culture. Prince released Purple Rain. Apple, that's the year they launched the Macintosh computer, and they did their whole Super Bowl ad, the 1984 one. MTV had their first ever Video Music Awards, so a lot happening in pop culture that year. Also in 1984, Nike is on the verge of shutting down their basketball shoe division. Low sales. Nike as a company is like on the verge of bankruptcy. Not well. Things not going well at Nike. So in response to this, Nike has to find a new spokesperson for their basketball shoes. So anyone who watched the movie Air is probably familiar with a lot of this story. But they have to go find a new spokesperson. So Nike's executives are looking at the draft that year and everyone who came from the draft about the start that season. And this guy, Michael Jordan, he was third pick in the draft. And he kind of seems off limits because he was like a big fan of Adidas. He always wore Adidas. Everyone assumed he was going to go there. And he was expensive. And Nike, you know, in the financial position they were, they didn't have a ton to spend on a superstar like him. And so go watch the movie Air if you want that whole backstory. But basically, after like 3 to 4 months of really hard, like pursuing Michael Jordan, they were able to land him. And they paid him $2.5 million over 5 years, about $500,000 a year. One of the other things that enticed him and brought him onto the team is they created a signature shoe for him. And so they were creating, this guy, Peter Moore, the creative director at Nike, designed this shoe specifically for Michael Jordan. At the time, this idea of like a signature shoe was kind of, it was very new. It really hadn't been done before. And the reason for that is in the NBA, shoes were like pretty much, they were mandated that they all be white. They were pretty much all look the same. Everyone on the team kind of wore the same shoe. And so they created this shoe for Michael Jordan that was all red and black. So it was very different from every other shoe that was being worn in basketball at the time. And they originally called it the Jordans, but eventually they called it the Air Jordans. And the reason being that Michael Jordan soared through the air, his agent at the time, apparently in an exec meeting, came up with the name because he, you know, anyone who's watched Michael Jordan dunk, he kind of soared through the air. So they created his own signature shoe for him. And so I'm going to kind of touch on why a couple of reasons why this launch, I think, was like the best pre-internet launch. And maybe the internet was around by then, but let's say like the best popular internet launch at the time before the internet became an actual thing that we used. First was the pre-launch. So they didn't actually release the shoe until they built a ton of hype around it. And so here's some of the ways they did it. So the first time anyone saw Jordan wear the signature shoe was at an exhibition game in New York. So this is probably likely before the season started. And also before they launched, he actually wore them in his first dunk competition. So he started wearing them before they actually launched them. And so people were starting to see these. The story goes in that game where he wore them in New York. All these kids were like freaking out because he was wearing these shoes that were so different from what everyone else was wearing on the court. And the other thing that was really good at building hype around this was controversy. So this actually would have been a great one for our last podcast, but this idea of building controversy around this product, because it was against regulation for NBA, he was actually fined every time he wore the shoe in a game. So at the time, shoes were white. David Stern, who was like the commissioner of the league at the time, was like, "That we can't have these shoes." So they fined him $5,000. Nike paid the $5,000 every time. It was like a blessing in disguise. They were like, "This is great." They built the whole launch campaign was around this idea of what became the banned shoe. So they really like ran with that idea. And the fact that it was like anti-establishment to want these shoes, to wear these shoes, people were dying to get their hands on these shoes. So there's a Nike commercial around when this launched. So the launch basically commercial with this, and Grayson, toss it up on the screen when you do it in post-production. But basically it is a Michael Jordan bouncing a basketball. When it gets down to his shoes, sensor bars go over his shoes. And the voiceover, it says on September 15th, Nike created a revolutionary new basketball shoe. On October 18th, the NBA threw them out of the game. Fortunately, the NBA can't stop you from wearing them. So by the time these come out, everybody wants a pair. Another thing that makes these really special, there's a great Time article written by this writer, Emil Wilbekin, if I pronounce his name right. And he's saying also at the time when this is coming out, there's also a new renaissance of Black culture, entertainment, and sports that's dominating the news, box offices, TV, and public popularity. So he actually wrote, and this is a quote from his article, he says, "For me as a Black teenager growing up in Cincinnati, I looked to the bright lights of Black excellence as a North Star, and one figure in particular, a rookie for the Chicago Bulls named Michael Jordan, who looked like me, seemingly soared to the air and scored points on the court." So he says the secret sauce that made them so popular was that they were made for consumers who didn't just like basketball and play basketball. It was like everyone wanted to wear this shoe because it represented a lot more than just playing basketball. And then the last thing was Michael Jordan was just a superstar. So by the end of his first season, he was rookie of the year, most famous basketball player of all time. And Michael Jordan and the Jordans, as part of that, just were a major success from day one and have stayed that way ever since. So a couple of numbers here. So when the first year they released the Jordans, they were expecting about 3 million in sales. That year they earned 162 million, which is crazy. Jordan 1s are some of the most coveted. They're some of the most coveted shoes today. In 2020, Sotheby's auction house sold a pair of them for $560,000. And if anyone's not aware of how much the Jordan brand generates, in 2021, their shoes generated $4.8 billion in revenue. 2022, $5.1 billion. 2023, it was $6.59 billion. So, and if anyone's familiar with like what made Jordan a billionaire today is that back when he negotiated his endorsement deal with them, unheard of at the time is he was one of the first people to actually put a royalty clause in there. So he didn't just get that $500,000 a year. He got a percentage of every shoe. That's why he's like one of the richest people in the world. So that's it.
Right, yep. On the buzzer.
Yeah, that was great. Let me just say, first off, you know, I will say that Air Jordan, much better pick than Chicken Nuggets.
Yeah.
Just a better pick overall. So I'll give that one to
thank
you,
Jason, yes. For sure.
I do think one of the, I saw the movie. I, you know, am not into sports, but my partner works in sports. And so we went to see the movie. Really enjoyed it. Loved the story. But I feel like one part of the movie that you kind of touched on here was, I think part of their original strategy was typically they would sponsor a bunch of different athletes. So they would kind of like hedge their bets. And I think in order for them to get Michael Jordan for this, they needed to, instead of sponsoring 12 people, only sponsor him and go kind of all in. I might be a bit fuzzy on the numbers, but it was that concept. And I think that's something really interesting that we can take back to the concept of launch, because I don't know about you guys, but so often when I'm dealing with stakeholders, people kind of like, well, we don't want to go all in, or what if this might also work? And it's really a testament to like, sometimes you just have to believe in the strategy and like really zone in on what you believe to be true. And like, yes, there was risk there. Like, what if Michael Jordan had gotten injured in his first season? Like, this could be a completely different story. But it was almost like they're playing to the upside rather than managing the downside. And I feel like so many companies just try to manage the downside and then they just never get this amount of growth and hype.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And if they had went with multiple players too, like they would have just picked up multiple okay players and none of them were, it's kind of like people who, you know, for your launch, it's like picking one strategy and going all in on that strategy or that tactic and putting versus spreading it out across. It's like, it's the same amount of investment, but the former way, it's like, you're not really going to get much impact across each one. Whereas the other, it's the opportunity, if it's the right one, that you're going to get outsized returns on it. In this case, like they did. So, but yeah, it was a good one. It's a good example too. Like a comparison today is, I guess, picking the right influencer to back your product in a way, right? For people who might in another industry that's not sports, for example. And I guess that is something we're starting to see more of.
I was going to ask, is that like the $500,000 per year over a few year period? Like how much, I know you mentioned the piece about the royalty clause being different, but like, did they spend more on him versus they would for a typical athlete at that time? Like how much were like Adidas, how much like were they like endorsing athletes for? Like what was the comment, like the average, would you say? Do you know?
I don't know the average. Like so there's a couple discrepancies between the movie and like reality. In the movie, it was 250 a year, I think. And then Adidas just matched it. But in reality, I think it was more like it was that 2.5 million was the actual number over 5 years. So it was 500,000 a year. I do believe like the other shoe companies were probably willing to pay him a similar amount. I think the royalty thing was a little different. And I do think that since every other company was just making white basketball shoes, like the signature shoe probably had something to do with it too.
Yeah, that's true.
If anyone watched the movie as well, I don't know how much this is Hollywood, but like this idea of how they just sold Jordan on Nike too and just tried to make him feel like we are going to care about you. All these other companies like Adidas, like you're just one of many stars that they have. You will be our star and we'll care about you more.
Yeah, that's a huge differentiator, I would say, like from an influencer perspective, just because I know like from like in the drum world, like I play drums and there's like the big symbol provider, which is Zildjian, and they have like a very like select set of symbols and you have to play theirs. But then there's a competitor of theirs, Paiste, and a lot of drummers will go there because they'll make specific set, like a symbol line for them. And so a lot of drummers, like, you know, there's definitely a prestige in going to Zildjian because it's like these symbol maker, but there's also like the, I don't know, having your own line that can be really cool for some drummers. And so I think there's definitely something to be said about that.
Nice.
Well, we know who's up next.
Yeah. All right, Tamara, you want to take us home?
I'm ready for it.
Yeah, let's do it.
3, 2, 1.
Okay, so for today's episode, I'm going to take us all the way back to 1947 and the launch of the modern day engagement ring. I also didn't know that we had criteria. So I've written down Andy's criteria so I can wave it into my example of lasting power, innovation, and market response. But
we didn't have that. Let me just interrupt you. I do that so I can position myself as the winner for this contest.
And I'm going every last. Time. And I'm going last. So I get to use this against you.
No, that's not allowed. You make your own.
Today, marriage and diamond rings are synonymous, right? We would never think of one without the other. But it actually wasn't the case. And not so long ago, it wasn't the case. At the time, diamond rings were very, very rare. The concept of the engagement ring had actually been around since the medieval times, Middle Ages, but they were never widely adopted, okay? So only 10% of the engagement rings that did exist even contained a diamond. They were often a completely other jewel altogether. Also important to know was at the time, a diamond mine called De Beers, which is a jewelry store we know today, controlled the global diamond supply. So it was an entire monopoly. This meant that they had a vested interest in driving demand for engagement rings, but they didn't actually really care where you bought it from. So they didn't know if you bought it from Tiffany's or Cartier or a local shop. They just wanted you to buy a diamond ring. And so I thought they took a really interesting strategy here. They actually engaged an ad agency to help them assess why diamonds weren't selling. So they did some market research, which we know as product marketers, very important part of the job. And essentially, the agency decides after all the research that they're going to pursue a category creation strategy. They're going to create the category of diamond engagement rings. And so they do extensive research around the societal attitudes around diamonds, which I think is really important. And they essentially build a campaign that is going to change how society feels about these diamonds. We know that this is very hard to do. It is kind of like the crux of category creation. They're essentially building demand for something where there's no demand today. And what the research actually showed was that consumers felt that diamonds were reserved for the ultra rich. They were an ultimate luxury. And so women at the time were saying, well, they would rather they spent their money on like a new washing machine rather than a diamond ring. And so the campaign to launch diamond rings had one goal, and that was to make every person who gets married feel like they need a diamond ring. And I think we already know that that was very successful, but I'm going to walk you through the campaign and how they launched the campaign. So, you know, the most impactful part of the campaign that has lasting power, Andy, is the campaign slogan, "A diamond is forever." You might not have even known that that came from De Beers, but it did. It's still in use today, and it actually cemented this core belief around if you want your marriage to last, you need a diamond. You need that level of commitment. They also, with the campaign, wanted the average consumer to see diamonds everywhere. Obviously, this wasn't the case before that. So they hired a publicist as part of the campaign who would write into newspapers and magazines and try to pitch stories about celebrity engagements. And it's not that celebrities weren't being covered before, but like the ring and the engagement part weren't. And so they would write in all the stats about the ring, highlighting it, talking about it, like the way that we might see in a celebrity mag today. They also were quite ahead of their time, and they created a bunch of what I'll call inbound marketing material. This was essentially non-branded content, so it didn't have De Beers on it, didn't have Tiffany's on it, and it was just stories about engagements and happy couples. And in every single story, it kind of focused around how loved and happy the woman was because of the diamond that they received. And the women who didn't have diamonds weren't happy or loved. It's kind of sad, I know. And then finally...
That's terrible, just by the way. It is terrible. Yeah. Oh my God. Sorry, keep going.
This was the 40s. It was a different time.
Different era.
Finally, they heavily promoted the buying criteria that we know today, the 4 C's. So they did this for 2 reasons. The first one was it actually provided like a really tangible guide that would help the men know how to buy a diamond. It felt like super overwhelming before, right? But it was also a sneaky way for them to sell more of their smaller diamonds. So the research study actually found that consumers thought that it wasn't even worth buying a diamond unless it was large. And so the campaign was meant to market other parts of the diamond. So cut, clarity, color, to help minimize the importance of the carat size and increase the importance of the other sizes. So that was the main campaign. But there was a couple interesting fast follows or rolling thunders that came a year or two later. So they actually did some product placement in the 1953 movie Gentlemen Prefer Blondes. And they're the ones who are responsible for getting Marilyn Monroe to sing the song Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend. And this was a fun fact that I did not know this before I started researching, was that they were the ones who also started dressing movie stars and socialites in diamonds for large events like the Academy Awards and the Kentucky Derby. And obviously this has lasted until today, right? Massive jewelry stores will dress celebrities for these events. So was the campaign successful? I think we've shown it has lasting power. We've shown that it was innovative. But did the market respond? Great question, Andy. The campaign was a success, and the sale of diamonds increased by 55% in less than 2 years. So it was also like an immediate success, which for such a high ticket item, I think is pretty impressive. In 1939, diamond sales were 23 million. And this increased to 2.1 billion by the end of the century. We talk a lot about how positioning and messaging needs to evolve over time, but when you nail it, you nail it. And since 1948, the line, "A diamond is forever," has been in every single De Beers engagement ring ad. And we are talking a 20th century. In 1999, "A diamond is forever" was named as the slogan of the century by Advertising Age. And today, 3/4 of all American brides wear a diamond engagement ring. Talk about shifting societal norms. That's my case.
Wow. Wow, wow, wow.
Well done.
Great job. Yeah, that was an excellent frame there of all of those things. Just so well thought through. And I could tell you had been thinking about that for, you know, all
week.
Be
clear for the listeners, that criteria is not real criteria. So...
No. So everyone should just know that Jason didn't follow that format.
Didn't follow the fake criteria.
The made up. It's just like the points of the show. It's all made up. It's all good.
Score doesn't matter. The one thing that also I really like, but I don't know if it's something that De Beers did as part of this, but the whole idea of what was it like setting the price of a diamond, of what you should expect to pay for an engagement ring, like, was that them too?
It was, but it was not part of this campaign. So I had to keep it short. But basically, several years after this campaign, once they had everyone buying a diamond ring, you know, they're thinking, well, how can I increase average order size? And so they're the ones who came out with the idea of 2 months' salary. And also, I would say that this idea has had lasting power until today. It's pretty common that, you know, if someone goes to buy a diamond ring, they might use this as a benchmark.
Yeah. That's like a cool way to just kind of set a price, like the price of what people should expect to pay for your product. Super interesting. And the 3 C's is really cool too, because thinking of like buyer enablement, like if people feel like they have a better sense of how to evaluate that product just by, you know, a lot of cases, I'm sure it's kind of made up and they're just like, but at least it gives me confidence in that I know what I'm doing and feel more comfortable with what I'm buying. It's really smart.
Well, that's exactly it. And like they didn't invent the 4 C's, but they saw an opportunity to market it as the criterion. I think it does. It is. It's essentially like buyer enablement for the diamond ring. And I can see how it's like, you just go, you check your little boxes, you know what to expect. And it also gave them another lever to be able to like scale prices up and down too, right? Not just based on carat.
I think that is the most important piece. And I can speak to that just from a buyer's perspective, because when I proposed to Sydney, my partner, I was super overwhelmed by the idea of like buying a diamond ring, and didn't really like, all I really knew was like carat size as being kind of like a way of understanding how like valuable a diamond was. But then going and understanding how cut, color, clarity, carat, like all those things are super important, and understanding like really like how you can balance each of those to getting a ring that you can feel confident about. I think that's a big piece. You know, obviously you want to give a great diamond ring to, you know, your fiance. It's also about like you feeling confident in making that decision. So it's like they're considering both the buyer and the end user in that kind of marketing tactic. So I thought it was super smart. This was a really fun topic. Yeah. I really enjoyed you know, we're always like diving into, you know, tech launches and stuff like that, which, you know, makes sense. It's like the world that we live in, but there's so many good things that we can get from, you know, classic classic marketing. That's like one of the most fun things to like flip through like old ads for a bunch of older products. It's super fun.
Totally. I mean, there's some fundamentals and foundations that have applied for decades, right? I think as we've shown in this episode, and it is interesting. Sometimes we feel like we're like chasing the hottest thing, or, you know, some executive at your company says, we need to do this. But sometimes just like taking a step back and thinking about like, what's something that's worked time and time again is a great way to start when you're thinking about planning a launch.
Yeah, that's what I like about product marketing, because it is, in my opinion, it's like the oldest form of marketing. It's like, how do you position a product, right? How do you launch a product? Like, there's so many things today around like content marketing or social media, or like a lot of like common things with demand gen. They're like new things with new tech that came with new technology in a lot of cases. Whereas a lot of the fundamentals of product marketing are just like the foundational product, like marketing things that we're using a lot of these markets.
Totally. I mean, in all the examples we gave, it's like all three companies were trying to solve a business problem, right? They all zeroed in on the target buyer, and they all built a narrative that kind of went beyond the product, really. That was kind of what I took from the episode. And those, to your point, Jason, are not dependent on channel or technique by any way.
Yeah. It kind of reminds me the 22 Immutable Laws of Marketing. That's a great book that I feel like, it's super short. I feel like most product marketers, if you've been like at it for a little while, you probably know about the book or have read it. If you're newer, then it's something that you should probably take a look at. But it's like all these like tried and true methods of marketing that you see companies kind of recycling or reusing over time. But it's been like going on for, you know, well over a century. So definitely worth checking out. But that's kind of what it reminded me of as we were going through all of these. I was like, I feel like I could see all these examples in as one of these like immutable laws.
That's cool.
Well, I'm super excited for next episode, because I think next episode we're going to talk about the greatest marketer of our time.
Hold on, Tamara. You're getting ahead of yourself. We have not even voted for the number one of this episode. Can we do the launch really quick? The launch vote?
Yeah,
you're right. Let's not spoil the surprise.
I feel good about this. Let's do this.
Okay.
Grayson, so we're all sending our votes Grayson. Over to Grayson now. Here we go.
Can I get a drum roll, please? We have our first three-way tie.
Get out!
No! What do we do? Do we just keep it the way it is?
This is for people listening, this is the first time.
So Grayson... This is
so, needs so, to be a winner.
I thought, doesn't Grayson need to come in and say it then?
I think we get producer vote.
Is
Grayson's the tiebreaker?
So you got to pick.
I can't handle this much pressure.
Grayson.
I can't handle this much pressure.
Oh my God! Hold on.
Do you mind if just for? I'm trying to think of a way to do this. So.
Just say who the best one was.
Do you each want to do a quick 10-second reminder just so I can get a refresher?
What are you talking about, a 10-second reminder? You've been here this entire episode.
We could do a final. I mean, only one of us were named the slogan of the century. That's an important thing to know.
You guys are going
to
let her say that and then not have your own 10 seconds.
First year of Jordan, it was expected only 3 million. Only 3 million expectation in their first year. It made 162 million.
Listen, I think that they both had fantastic launches.
Multiple billion dollars in revenue.
They both had fantastic launches. I don't want to take anything away from either of them. I think that it was just so wonderful. I learned so much from listening to both of them. And
well, then you're not going to vote for Andy's then. He's kind of voted himself out.
Listen, you do what you feel is right, Grayson. I think you're a very smart gentleman.
Grayson, you've probably worn Jordans before, haven't you?
I neither confirm. I plead the fifth.
Grayson, when you buy a diamond ring, you're going to need to know the four C's.
Wow. The power in my hands right now is getting to my head.
I'm about to dip out, guys. Later. Yeah. It's like the episode of The Office. Call. Oh, my God. No, you got to make the call. Here we go.
Give me 5 seconds. Okay. I have my answer.
And
I just like to say the reason.
No.
I thought it was a very unique take on a launch, and I'm going with the Michelin Guide.
Yes, thank you, God, a win. Give me one W. Thank you, God.
Oh, is this the first W?
This is my first W on the scoreboard. Thank you, Grayson.
Andy, I think it was well deserved. And I don't want to throw Jason under the boat here, but I did vote for you.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here amongst greats. This is so wonderful. And you know, we still have the people's vote. And so why don't we tell them how can listeners vote for their favorites?
Sure. So the day that this episode drops, I'm going to post a poll on my LinkedIn about all of the different cases that we've made today. And you vote. You'll have 7 days to vote for who you think should have won. We'll include a little description of each one so you know what to vote for. And then we'll announce that winner after a week.
Fabulous.
I'm excited. I'm glad that everyone's on the leaderboard now. It makes this season very spicy.
I was getting a little nervous. I was like, this is, if I don't get on the board at least once in the first four episodes, like, come on now. But I'm here. And I'm honestly, I'll just coast the rest of the time. I'll be good.
Just phone it in.
I'm going to phone it in for the rest of the season. Yeah. So I'm good.
I'm just getting fired up. I want to win everything.
I've got a good one for next week. The topic next week. Are we sharing the topic for next episode?
Yes. Yes. Now let's share the topic. Tease it.
Okay. Tamara had said this earlier. The topic next week is all about one of the greatest marketers of our time.
I said the greatest marketer of all time.
A recent new football fan, I think. Potentially, maybe have been a football fan all along, but that's Taylor Swift. And so we are each going to be talking about our favorite Taylor Swift launch. And
that's right.
It was an easy job to find three. So it just goes to show how good of a marketer she is.
Honestly, I had one like kind of in the back of my head when Tamara suggested this. I was like, okay, that's easy. It's one of those things. And then I think we all had our own choices within like a minute, to be honest.
Yeah. Have you?
I'm with you, and my ego is not going to take it if I don't win this episode. So like I need to get to work researching.
Right. All right. Maybe me and Jason will just team up on our launches and we'll just have a joint pitch against tomorrow.
Either myself or Andy will just completely, we won't even say anything. And it'll just be two of us do all the research on one.
Do like a PowerPoint presentation. Let's do it.
That's not fair.
Them's not the rules.
I love it. Well, I can't wait. This is going to be the best episode yet. I can feel it.
It is. All right. That's the pod. Again, thanks to the Compete Network over at Clue for helping us out with this podcast. And we will see you all next time.
See you, everybody.
See you.